Welcome to African Pod, and this edition is a fascinating conversation with a free-spirited novelist who writes with authentic African themes. My name is Philip Nyakpo, your host, and we're about to meet T.M. Clark, the novelist, born in Zimbabwe, with the experience of living in South Africa and the United Kingdom. Now she lives in Australia, from where she writes with African themes straight from the heart. Welcome back to African Pod. It's not often that you meet a writer who writes a novel with a mixture of modern life and deep-rooted stories from Africa told with an uncommon passion. Tina Marie Clark, or T.M. Clark, is that novelist with a unique experience, perspective, and passion which she draws on to write. Her latest book, Tears of the Cheetah, released in late 2015, is described by one reviewer as a thriller and a story of a fierce fight to save Africa's threatened wildlife, a suspenseful journey into the dark world of African game poaching. From her home in the Australian state of Queensland, T.M. Clark spoke to African Pod about her life, what she has learned living on three continents, as well as what she lives for. First, she told me about her early memories of Africa, a continent she still calls home.
In Africa, well, I grew up, so I had all my childhood there, my teenage years, and you know, I had my first child there as well. So I was already about 28, 29, I think, when I left. So, you know, I sort of like had the beginning of my life in, you know, in Zimbabwe and then in South Africa. And that's just, I still consider Africa home. But I also call Australia home. So I guess I'm a child of two worlds now. So.
And not just Australia and Africa, but also, in some ways, the United Kingdom.
Well, a little bit, but not so much. The United Kingdom, I had 2.5 years there. I was very, very ill when I was pregnant with my second child. So that was sort of 9 months sort of just, you know, there. And it was really cold. And, you know, and then when I did go back to work after a year, it was sort of, you know, you go to work in the dark and you come home in the dark. And, you know, when I tried to do any gardening, you know, my fingers were in cold dirt and I didn't enjoy that. So, yeah, so it was time to move on from England. Although I love England to visit and see everything, and I'll just be a tourist there if it's all right with everybody.
So why does Africa mean so much to you?
Oh, man, it's just, you know what, I think if you live in Africa and you just have a piece of you that it never lets go. It holds on to your heart always. I think maybe because I had such a controversial upbringing, you know, because I was brought up in a war zone, and even though we were in a war zone, we were still friends with, you know, to us in Zimbabwe, we didn't see as a child, you know, obviously, you know, like this was before 1980, so it was, you know, we didn't see everybody in different lights. You know, we were just sort of like on the farm with everybody else, and you know, the guys in the compound were my friends, and everybody just, you know, spoke to everybody. It was only when we went to school that, you know, we were separated and stuff like that into whites and blacks. And then, you know, 1980 happened, and I was already in grade six, so it was like, you know, we had girls come into the hostel with us who were black, and you know, and I remember my our matron scrubbing the one girl, and you know, and going, oh no, she has to be clean like everybody else, and you know, and then afterwards, like, you know, when we were all friendly and we were all talking to each other, how, you know, how that girl had said, you know, that like she never felt that she was, you know, that she was unclean, and we never ever felt that she was unclean. So it was just a different sort of, you know, like as you got older, you got introduced to different things, and I think that's sort of And different beliefs and different understandings and different, I don't know, different strokes, I guess, that people, you know, how people treated other people. And until then, I had never seen anybody treat anybody else any differently. And I think that is what sort of like still sits really, really deep in myself, is that, you know what, her and I, we were the same. We were from the same, you know, the same backgrounds. Okay, she was a daughter of a doctor, and I was, you know, a daughter of a farmer. But, you know, we were friends at school, and there was nothing that, you know, we did everything. So it's sort of like it brings to home sort of like that whole African thing is that you're black, you're not white, you're not colored, you're not Indian, you're not Chinese, you're not anything. You are just an African, and everybody's the same.
And having grown up partly in South Africa and in Zimbabwe, I'm assuming that you still remember some of the language, like the African language, African language, and also language from Zimbabwe.
I think I do. You know, in Zimbabwe, we obviously respect, we listen to my English. we spoke English, and we spoke Ndebele. But when we went to boarding school, we weren't allowed to speak to the staff in Ndebele. You had to speak to the staff in English. But, you know, at home we all spoke Ndebele to our, you know, to everybody, and just so everybody just understood everybody. And our guys on our farm and the ladies, you know, they all spoke really good English as well. So we're sort of like, you know, both of those. Then in senior school, when I moved to South Africa, there was a big difference. I actually moved to a Xhosa area, which is Kokstad, which is on the sort of the edge of the Transkei. So while there was a lot of Xhosa ladies there, there was also quite a few Zulus. So my language, my black languages, if you want to call them that, you know, for a better word for them, actually then became more of like a multicultural thing, because I then had the three languages all mixing together. So, you know, a couple of words that would, you know, like be very different, like a mazamban, you know, and it's a monkey in one place and it's a potato in another. So my actual language in itself, you know, became very different. And so it's sort of like a funny galore, sort of like just every language is thrown in there and everything just has to be understood.
And even as you speak right now, you've got an accent that is so beautifully mixed, and it's a London accent, it's an Australian Queensland accent, and it's a South African Zimbabwean accent.
It is, and it doesn't go away. It just stays. Everyone always says to me, you know, I stand up, I run this conference called the CYA Conference, which helps other writers and illustrators of children's literature get, you know, on their publishing journey. And I always forget that I sound different to the other Australians. And I stand up and I talk and I get these looks and like, oh, we never knew that you were like foreign. And it's like, you know, I've been here 15 years. I'm not foreign anymore. But I still, the accent just doesn't go away.
And so after you left Africa, at what point did you decide to become a novelist?
A novelist. Oh, at what point? I actually, I left school about 3 years after I left school. I left school, obviously, because my mum, we lived in a hostel where my mom was our matron in the boarding school. So when I left school, I went to family, and then they helped me sort of like get into my own flat and stuff like that. And then eventually I had my own flat after I'd met my husband, my husband now, but, you know, he was my boyfriend then. And we lived in my flat. And so when my sister left school, she came to live with me. And I remember lying on the beach with her at weekends, and I wrote like the three chapters of a Mills and Boon book, because at that stage that was all I read, was just Mills and Boon all the time. And I wrote these three chapters on like foolscap paper. And I had absolutely no idea, with all the moving around from then, you know, to now, I don't know what happened to it, but I actually had done that. And then it just got forgotten. And then only after I had my kids, and I used to tell them stories every night, and my husband kept telling me, you know, you should just write those down. You should write them down. And I used to tell them stories that carried on every day, you know, from one day to the next, and they would go, oh, what happened to him? What happened to him? You know. So it was just sort of like the oral telling of the stories. And then he said, I'll write them down. And it wasn't until we were in Paris for a weekend that I saw a magazine that had you could get £50 for 200 words, you know, if you wrote like a dear editor sort of letter. And I sort of was reading them, and I said to my husband, man, these people get £50 and they can't even speak English properly. Look at these letters. And he went, well, then if you think it like that, you know, do it. So I tore the page out, you know, with the details, and I started writing. And obviously I wrote one and it got published. And then I went, you know, okay, I can do this, because, it's, you know, now somebody's actually paid me. So I think that gave me a very big boost. And then, you know, I tried to do one of these courses, which, you know, you pay and you do by correspondence. But I am a terrible, terrible scholar. My husband's sitting behind me, he's laughing because it's very, very true. So I did like one of the course, you know, one of the modules, and I sent it away. And I did a second one, and I sent it away. And I think I got feedback on the one, and I never sent any more sort of thing. But one of the things they had said in that was, you know, oh, don't get your spouse to read your work. Well, that was about the only thing I got out of that course was don't get your spouse to read your work. So I would never let my husband read my work. And even after I had my
Until it is published?
Yeah, until it got published, yes. And now, I keep on now, you know, a couple of years down the line, like 6 years, I have my first children's book published. Only when it gets published, then he can read it. And then I'm going again, it's probably about another 2 years, and I'm really battling. And then he had to read something because my critique partners were all on deadlines and none of them could read it. And he turned out to be the best critique partner out. So now it's like I always say to everybody, you know what, depending on who your husband or your spouse is, you know, then you can sort of like use them or not use them to critique your work. But, you know, I just sort of like wish that maybe if I'd got him involved in my writing process a little bit earlier, it might have been a little bit easier on me. So
at the moment, you're a full-blown novelist writing specifically with African themes, very deep African themes. What does being a novelist in this genre mean to you?
Freedom, absolute freedom. I've been so lucky. I think because it's not something that a lot of people write on, or if they are writing on it, they're not trying to publish in it. I'm not sure. But because it's very different to what a lot of other people do, and it's a niche genre sort of thing, it's everybody loves Africa. Everybody's sort of like got this mystique about Africa. They all want to know about it. And so to me, it's been absolute freedom because I can write stories and in my head I can write wrongs. Like, I'm writing a story at the moment about an elephant, and I know that in my, you know, that the end of the elephant was actually not very good from the person who told me the story about the elephant. But in my head, I can correct that wrong and I can make it right. So I think it's just freedom to give people who I think need a happy ending, happy endings.
And I'm looking at your current book, released in 2015, Tears of the Cheetah, a suspenseful journey into the dark world of African game poaching. Now, I know also that Sherry Adair, in reviewing the book, said Africa is the evocative backdrop to this unpotable thriller and the story of a fierce fight to save its threatened wildlife. How did you feel coming across with a book, a novel, with such a theme?
You know, I've touched on poaching in my other two books, but it hasn't been a theme. So to theme this was a very different book for me. Because I actually themed it, you know, with the cheetahs, I hadn't actually done that before. I hadn't actually themed my animals and given my animals like a voice, where in this one I felt like the cheetahs were part of the character cast. So it was very different the whole time, focusing just, you know, on that animal. I think with the poaching part of it, it's a real problem. It's always been a problem in Africa. It's just getting worse, you know, as people encroach onto animal spaces, it's getting worse. So, you know, the animals have got less space, and more people love the animals, and they, you know, they want the animals, and they don't realize that, you know, half of them, if you ask them, you know, where the animal came from, they probably would say, oh, a pet shop, and they wouldn't even know where the animal actually started out, that it was a wild animal in the beginning, you know, and stolen from its mother. So for me, you know, the plight of the cheetah seemed like a good one to sort of like highlight the poaching epidemic.
And in going through the book myself, I found it fascinating. And just one little information that I thought was interesting is the fact and fiction area, where you actually explain what is fact in the book and what is fiction. And I found it interesting that you invented a town you call Crystalburg.
I know. I didn't want to put the type of pressure on one town that they would have, you know, like with these killings going on around their town. So I felt sorry before that, you know, for the town. So yes, so I used a place which I really know very, very well. An aunt of mine has a farm right up against the Drakensberg Mountains. It's like the last farm before Forest Street. So I know that area really, really well. And so I basically put my town right next to that, and so that, you know, if, you know, police and stuff like that, you know, the procedures, you know, nobody would go, oh, wait a minute, you know, so-and-so, or just in case I got somebody's name that was very similar to somebody who was there as well. I didn't want to do that, you know, in case I got somebody in trouble or something like that. So having a fictional town is actually what was really good for this book. Yeah, it was one of the things which I didn't want to pinpoint anybody and label anybody with any trouble.
And talking about poaching, the very dangerous and often heartless exercise in Africa, very much highlighted in your novel. So with your rural African background, the love of animals, any ideas on how poaching can be controlled? And I have in mind an example, the killing last year of Cecil the lion by the American dentist, which made global headlines.
Oh, Cecil, Sam, he was so sad. You know, I think that Cecil, he just highlighted what was happening everywhere, that animals have become a commodity in Africa, they have a price on them, and if any hunter wants to pay the price, they can get any animal, and it doesn't matter if it's collared, it doesn't matter if it's in a research project, name a price, anything, anywhere you can buy. And I think that I'm not getting into the whole hunting debate, because, you know, I believe people should be allowed to kill animals for the pot and just eat what they can consume. And that whole conservation side that hunters believe that they're contributing to when they pay fees and stuff like that. You know, Cecil himself was a tragedy, but I think that his death has done more for the anti-poaching campaign than any other animal at the moment. But he also probably highlighted a sport which many, many people probably weren't so aware of. And I think that there's going to be a whole fresh intake of hunters coming because of him, not knowing before that you could do that, and now being willing to actually go and kill, you know, like a progression maybe from, you know, from the games where people are, you know, killing everybody on the games to progression to actually doing it and paying for it to justify, oh, well, you know, it's just an animal and I'm paying for it. So, but, you know, so the book's not on hunting. It's more on the poaching side of it. And this book, I was particularly going for the live animal poaching, because a lot of people now, there is a lot of focus on the shooting of the animals and the killing of them, but they've forgotten that there's a whole other side of it that is actually the live animal poaching, the people who go and steal the babies and send them through, and they take birds and out of their natural environment and put them in cages and ship them for miles and miles, and, you know, and then on the other side they get sold. So the actual poaching theme itself is actually on the live trade of the animals, which is just as drastic. I mean, obviously, you know, with poaching, with hunting, you know, it's one animal and that's over and done with, you know, for that one hunter. But, you know, with poaching, it's the people that they've got their grounds and they go back to those grounds and they totally, like, you know, annihilate the animals in those areas. And they don't, you know, the animals don't have a chance to repopulate and regroup. So, actually, what can be done about it? It's not my area of expertise. I think that we're coming up to sort of like in my book, My Brother But One. I actually brought up. I actually had the guy in that book who my hero was. He used to train people for anti-poaching. You know, so he would teach them the bush skills and would train the poachers to fight against the poachers. Train the anti-poachers. Gosh. Train the anti-poachers to fight. And I think that is where it is moving more and more. You hear all these stories about these commandos and these, you know, and all these elite soldiers who are going over there to try and protect the wildlife. And I think that basically that's what's going to happen. We're going to have full-on armies in every game reserve and game park trying to just keep the animals alive.
And so coming back to your book, you write with such extraordinarily warm feeling towards Africa, and it's something that is uniquely personal to you as well. But on a larger point, Africa's continent is perceived to be leading with the three Ds: disease, death, disaster. So what's your perception on that? Why would you have such a warm feeling for a continent that is so painted?
Yeah, I have to laugh at that, because that is how some people do see Africa. And it's really sad, because, you know, people see things through their own eyes and they see things through their own hearts. So some parts are like that. You know, there is disease and death and disaster, and there's extreme cruelty, you know, cruelty which to other people would not imagine. You know, things that I saw growing up in a war zone, the extreme of the cruelty, but then also the extreme of the kindness. But everybody seems to focus on the negative, and they don't actually shine the light on the very positive things that happen in Africa. I'll give you a very good example. My mom-in-law got lost in Africa, in South Africa. She was in KwaZulu. She lived in KwaZulu-Natal, so she lived in Mhlanga Rocks. The closest township to her is actually KwaMashu. So she went into KwaMashu by mistake. So she's in KwaMashu. My mom-in-law, she loves her ring, so she's got lots of gold on her fingers. And she went in there by mistake, and she was driving a BMW. So she phoned my dad-in-law and said, you know, she's lost, obviously. So they set off the beacon. The people, they rush, you know, because when you set off a beacon with a GPS tracker, you know, they have to rush to go and find the person, because there's so many killings and so many hijackings. But what happened to her? An old man just knocked on the front of her car and said, "Madam, you're in the wrong place. Turn around." And he walked her out of KwaMashu until she was in a much better place. And the other people who had rushed to help her actually met her there. Now, that was one old man walking, seeing somebody in trouble where she shouldn't be, and she was fine. And it's that type of story that people forget, that there are good things in Africa. There are really good people in Africa as well. And the people in Africa who are good, I think that ultimately, hopefully, they will overcome the bad. But, yeah, there is, it's just sort of like that whole, it's so easy to focus on the negative, but there is so much positive as well in the whole continent.
And for you, as a white African, I mean, it's not a conventional view of Africans, but there are millions of white Africans. One of them is you, having been born there, raised there.
I'm laughing your way. At you. Calling you that. I was in New York last year, and this black guy was, they were selling their music, and he shook my hand, and he goes, because I went to buy a CD of his, and he went, "Oh, shake the hand of a black man." And then he looked at me and he said, "Oh, you probably never shook a black man's hand before." And I went, "Oh, please." And I said to him, "I was born in Zimbabwe, raised in South Africa." I said, I've hugged plenty of black men in my life. And he said to me, "Girl, you're more black than I am." And I had to laugh, because in a way it is true, because yes, we are true Africans. We are not just a white elitist and a black elitist and and everything else. We are just Africans, and that's how I see myself.
And I've got to get you to explain that more. So the question is, to what extent do you embody Africa?
Oh, that's a hard one. Okay, embodying Africa is, that's such a personal thing. I think that, everybody sees everything within their own eyes. So I embody my vision of Africa. I cannot live in Africa anymore, because the type of work that my husband does cannot be done, you know, in Africa. He works a lot on computers and stuff like that. He cannot sit in the bush somewhere and get like a perfect signal to work, you know, dial into his office. So I cannot live in Africa, but that doesn't mean that, you know, like that I suddenly don't see Africa in a different, you know, like just because I'm a first world princess now living in Australia, that I don't still have lots of empathy for Africa and want to help and want to just sort of like always be there. But I think that each person sees with their own eyes and their own heart, and the Africa I see is probably different to the Africa that somebody standing right next to me would see. So a lot of people would go, wow, you know, you're from South Africa, but, you know, then they sort of like just assume, because you're from South Africa, that you are racist and that you are against a black person. I was at a hockey tournament here where one of the girls in my team was an Aboriginal, and she painted an Aboriginal flag on my face. And I was playing, and this one girl said to me, turned around and said, but you're from South Africa. How can you have a black person's flag on your face? And I went, well, why not? I'm playing with her, and, you know, this is our team. And she said, but, you know, you're a racist. You hate the blacks. And I went, well, I actually don't, as a person, hate the blacks. And that is a really generalized sort of, you know, thing to say. And she seemed quite taken aback that I would be prepared to have an Aboriginal flag on my face, even though I came from South Africa. So I think that a lot of perceptions of different people, obviously you do, you have your very, your far right wing and your far left wing of everybody. But I think that for me, Africa is just home.
And Tina, your books, particularly The Tears of the Cheetah, the latest one, is like an artifact that explains Africa in a new, refreshing way. How do you think some of those refreshing ways of explaining Africa could become more widespread?
Education. I think that a lot of it is there, and I think that a lot of people want exactly that. And there are people who are exactly like I write in my books.
Tina, having again been raised, born in Zimbabwe, and lived in South Africa through England, and now living in Australia, what would you say you have learned through all these experiences?
Probably to be the best person you can be. What I've learned is there's many other people who are a lot more disadvantaged than what I am, and no matter what happened to me, I must be a better person. The world I viewed in the eyes of a five-year-old, you know, is very different to the eyes that I view now at nearly 50 years old. So, I would think that I've probably learned, and tolerance of everybody is probably a thing that I've learned in Africa as well, and just, you know, and just, I suppose as well, that there's a saying in South Africa, it says, Boer maak 'n plan, which, you know, it's the farmer makes a plan, and I think that's one of the things that I sort of like, think when I think Africa, it's like everybody just makes a plan to fight every day to just live.
That favorite quote of yours, Tina, a farmer makes a plan. Can you explain that?
Just, you know, the farmers, they, anywhere in Southern Africa that I've been, you'll always see the farmers, and they're always making a plan. You know, if the rain doesn't come, that's okay. They make a plan. They put in irrigation. If something happens, if it's raining and they've got all the water and it's flooding, that's okay. You know, they make a plan and they raise their houses up, or they do something. They're always trying to, no matter what sort of hits you, you sort of like you overcome it, and you just get up and you carry on. And you just make things work. So if you want something to happen, you have to make it work. So, and obviously it's not just the farmers, you know, that's just the saying. But, you know, it's, like a donkey cart, okay? Like the guys who have got a donkey cart, traditionally they would have built like a, like a wooden cart to go behind it and got the wheels and things. Now you see the donkey carts, and most of them have got like the back of the ute, you know, the tray part of the ute, and they use that as a donkey cart. So they've made a plan. They've modernized a little bit, and they're making it easier for the donkey, because now, you know, it's more aerodynamic, it's light, it works better. So it's just, you just do something and make it work. And you use what you've got, and you just make it work.
And you've turned out to be a prolific novelist. So, what's for the future?
I'm writing my next book at the moment, and its working title is called Child of Africa. It's more sort of like a going home theme. It's about a guy who goes home, and, you know, he's broken, and he goes home to heal, but he finds that, you know, the land around him is actually more broken than what he is, and in healing himself, he heals his land, and then, and it's sort of like the importance of people relying on each other within the community. And one of the underlying themes in that book is actually the, you know, in Zimbabwe and the Ndebele culture, they used to hide. It's not so much anymore. They don't try to do it anymore, but it used to be very traditional that they would hide their children if their children had any deformity. So it sort of like brings that forward into sort of like the modern day light, you know, of this tradition. And, you know, because a lot of my books, like the last book, it's, you know, not Tears of a Cheetah so much because that didn't have so much of it in it. But the book before was very much based on, you know, like the traditions of, you know, of the black people around, of the Shona people in Zimbabwe and some of their parts of their religion and how it impacted and stuff like that. So this is sort of like, okay, I'm sort of like just doing it on part of Ndebele culture, which impacted, you know, and how that is sort of like coming through. So, yeah, it's still writing. I can't not write. I can't suddenly just, you know, stop writing stories. There's so many stories in my head. They have to actually be told. So, you know, even if nobody reads them, they would still land up on a computer file somewhere.
So, Tina, I wanted to ask you, apart from writing, are there some other special projects you're involved in?
I actually am. I'm very involved with, there's two projects I'm involved in. The one is the Mother Africa Project, which is actually in Zimbabwe, and the other one is the Books for Papua New Guinea. Now, the Mother Africa Project, I actually started, was actually what started off the PNG project, was that I had been back to Zimbabwe in 2010-11, and I had seen, you know, like the lack of books in you know, I went back and found my maid, and she said to me she needed books to teach her grandchildren. And so I came back and I put out a call for books and I got all these books, and then I found that I couldn't actually afford the $20,000 or $30,000 to get the container to Africa and cleared through customs and, you know, and pay duties and everything else. So that sort of like left me with a whole heap of books. And then my friend actually was starting this Papua New Guinea project. So the books got diverted for there, but we had already started raising money. So we've still got that money sitting there. And actually, Tony Park was part of the original sort of group who got together with me, and we raised money a little bit there. So what we're doing now is we've gone, right, now that we've got the sustainable route there, we are now looking to find a sustainable route through to Africa to do the same thing, to send the books there. And I'm hoping to get a container through to Zimbabwe, like, within the next year or, you know, 18 months, which will be very, very exciting. That's my special project that I do is basically taking textbooks, taking all sorts of books from a First World nation who just throws them out and sending them to where people do need books.
What sort of help do you think others who might be willing be able to give you?
Well, if there's willing help, always... obviously, there's always the money side of it to get the book across Africa. If there's somebody who takes a container from the Brisbane area to Africa anywhere, and they have space for anything, if they would, you know, they contact me, you know, that would be fantastic, because we can always try and put books in it. Because, you know, many people in South Africa as well, as you know, and the whole way up Africa, obviously, also know that, you know, there's always a village that needs books. There's always some place that needs books that doesn't, you know, that can't afford them and that could use some books. So if they just want to contact me, that's always fine. We can try and, you know, get the books to spread and try and make a more sustainable route into South Africa. And that gives me a gateway into Africa, because, you know, everything is just rail from there to get books up and further.
And, Tina, what's the best way for people to contact you, either on this project or just in relation to your writing career as a novelist?
Probably on email. And if you just email at tina@tmclark.com.au. Or otherwise my CYA website as well, which is the cyaconference.com. They, you know, welcome to just contact me on either of those.
Well, Tina, your passion for Africa is clear, having been born right there, no longer living there, living your life in Australia, but your passion and love for Africa is so clear. We would like to thank you very much for speaking to African Pod, Tina.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
I was speaking to T.M. Clark, a novelist with indelible memories of being born and raised in Africa. She now lives in Australia, from where she writes novels with authentic African themes, including her latest book, Tears of the Cheetah. For more on the good news and bad news about Africa, subscribe free to the African Pod on YouTube. African Pod is also available on iTunes Podcast and TuneIn Radio, all free on the internet. Follow us on Twitter at African Pod. You can contact African Pod by going to our website, africanpod.com. My name is Philip Nyapo, and thanks for listening.